Welcome back for part two of my fantastic supersized conversation with the one and only Dara Horn. If you haven't listened to part one yet, hit pause on this, jump back to last week, get yourself caught up, and then rejoin us. In the meantime, we're going to get started. Dara, one more big concept from People of Dead Jews that I want to talk about is Merchant of Venice, which you get into. And as an actor, an English major, this really hit home for me. Basically, you break down how this is a wildly anti-Semitic, grotesque caricature of a Jew with no redeeming qualities, whose downfall is celebrated, whose daughter abandons her Judaism to marry a Christian and run away. And it's so widely performed, so widely regarded, entirely unquestioned. Like, why is your book the first time I'm hearing anybody talk about this?
You know, look, in the book I write about listening to a BBC production of this in the car with my then 10-year-old son,
yeah,
which was this sort of amazing thing where I realized, like, how much gaslighting there is around that play, right? How you're supposed to regard it as this, like, you know, amazing moment of humanity because Shylock has this monologue that's like, I am a Jew, hath not a Jew eyes, organs, dimensions,
right.
You know, if you prick us, do we not bleed? And it's like, look, this is this amazing show of this person's humanity. And my 10-year-old son,
yeah, I love this,
you know, got to the, I mean, like, we're listening to this play and it's just like, you know, horror show, anti-Semitic caricatures and stereotypes that this 10-year-old can't miss.
Right. From, as you say, Shakespeare, who likely had never met a Jew in his life.
Of course, right. Yeah, I mean, although, you know, look, there was this, you know, anti-Semitic scandal about this,
right.
This
doctor. Right, he plucked it from the news.
Yes, right. I mean, because there was a converted Portuguese Jewish doctor who was the physician to Queen Elizabeth I, and he was accused of poisoning her, and he was executed by, like, crowds shouting, hang the Jew. And that was the big news story, like, right before Shakespeare wrote this play.
Hmm.
So, gee, I remember listening in the car with my 10-year-old son to this, you know, that monologue.
Yeah.
And he says to me, he's like, wait, you fell for that? And I was like, what do you mean? And he says, this is the evil supervillain monologue that every evil supervillain does, like in every superhero movie, you know, like, oh, I've had a rough life, and if you were me, you'd do the same thing, and,
right,
you know, that's why I'm gonna go kill Batman, muhahaha, right? He's like,
he got it.
Oh, yeah, it was obvious to a 10-year-old.
Reading about Merchant of Venice and the way you speak about it made me think of Roald Dahl,
mm,
who, for those of you who don't know, was a vicious anti-Semite.
Oh, proud of it, too.
Like, yeah, very outspoken, mm-hmm, saying, you know, one of his quotes is, I'm not just anti-Israel, I'm an anti-Semite.
Oh, yeah, I mean, it was like, you know, Hitler didn't pick on the Jews for no reason.
For no reason,
it was like,
right,
it was nothing subtle, right?
The Jew, like, inherently provokes animosity or something. Like, really,
yes,
gross stuff. And, you know, to quote Michael Solomonov, who we had on this show once, where's the fucking outrage? Do you think it comes from, just as we were saying earlier, like, a total lack of awareness and ignorance? Or is there some sort of nefariousness underneath this?
I wrote a piece about Roald Dahl for a few years ago for Jewish Review of Books. I wrote it when there was a yet another movie production of the book The Witches,
mm-hmm,
that came out. The Witches is this book about, you know, that it's basically saying that there's this, like, group of what appear to be women who are actually witches who are trying to eat children. It's like, you know, they have big noses and, you know, they're bald and they wear wigs,
mm,
which is like, you know, that's actually a practice in some Hasidic communities,
sure,
where women cover their hair. And then there's like this, like, devilish thing where, you know, they have hooves instead of feet, right? I mean, it's like, it goes straight to this, you know, they could smell children and they're hunting you down. It gets worse than that, though. Then they print their own money. I could not make this up. They print their own money. Then there's, like, the Grand High Witch holds these, like, meetings of the Grand High Witches of all the world. And it's like, it's straight out of the Protocols of the Elders of Zion. And then you meet the Grand High Witch. I could not make this up. She has a Yiddish accent.
In
the book.
In the book?
In the book.
Huh.
Yeah. She has a Yiddish accent. She's printing her own money. And they're talking about how they want to kill children.
Right.
This is like a straight up medieval blood libel. And
yeah,
I'm just like reading this to, like, you know, at the time my 8-year-old, and I'm just like, this is disturbing.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, and it's like, there's this deep sadism in his work that, I mean, it's part and parcel of this because that's what this is about. I mean, this is about sadism.
You'll never be able to read Roald Dahl the same way again. Okay, so now I want to get a little into you, Dara, the person. Your mother was also an academic, English teacher with a PhD in Jewish studies. How influential was she on the path that your life has taken?
dramatically.
Yeah, I would imagine.
Yeah. So, you know, it's funny because my mother grew up in a family that was fairly assimilated in a lot of ways. I mean, she talks about, you know, growing up like with a Christmas tree. You know, her family was members of a synagogue, though, you know, and they sent her to Hebrew school. And that was, you know, that was like everybody did that. And she met a teacher at her Hebrew school who she just kind of fell in love with in a lot of ways. Like, yeah. She really became really attached to this teacher. This teacher later became the chair of the Jewish Studies department at NYU, and she followed him and did her PhD from him at NYU. And that's I knew this man growing up. Like, I mean, he was like our family's teacher. His name was Dr. Nathan Winter, Zichrono Livracha, may his memory be a blessing. He really, like, you know, was, you know, trained her in a sense of like having this really broad view of Jewish civilization and this amazing history. And the way that looked in my family growing up was me and my siblings. So I'm one of four siblings, and we were expected to bring this kind of creativity into our family's Jewish life. So it was the kind of thing where, like, for the Passover Seder, we, the four children, we were assigned to, you know, present this sort of like creative storytelling of the Passover story. We would like write, you know, parody Broadway show tunes, and we would put on skits, you know, musical numbers, and, you know, all sorts of things like that.
Something you look forward to, or is it like homework?
Very much looking forward to it. Yes, hugely looking forward to it. I've turned this up to 11 with my own family, which I'm happy to tell you about.
Yeah.
But also just infusing us with that sort of deep, not just pride, but real knowledge, and having the basis be knowledge. And I mean, it was the kind of thing where, you know, we traveled a lot when I was growing up, and you know, so I had the opportunity to see Jewish communities in places around the world.
Yeah, I read you said you've been to like 40 countries in your childhood. I mean, that's a lot of countries.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it was like, wasn't a vacation unless you had to, like, you know, get some kind of shot before you, you know, got on the plane.
It's so interesting to hear you say all that, because the next thing I wanted to talk about was sort of the tree trunk of your Jewish identity. Based on, you know, listening to you speak and having read a bunch of your work, what I would say it appears your tree trunk is this acknowledgement of this unbroken chain of what it is to be a Jewish, this continuum throughout history. It's sort of at the center of everything you seem to think about and write about. Is that an accurate assessment?
Yes. It's at the center of who I am. It mostly comes from my family, obviously.
Yeah.
My parents, you know, in addition to sort of just the way they've educated us, and my mother being, you know, having this academic background. I mean, my father was like a person who was like, you know, minionaire. He's like, you know, the guy who's there like a weekday minion. You know, he's that guy.
Yeah.
You know, my mother ran the adult education programs, and, you know, she also had other roles. For me, this also overlapped with my identity as a writer, because as a writer, I was motivated by what I've thought about as the problem of time.
Yeah.
My motivation as a writer didn't come from like, oh, I want to make up stories. You know, I would get to bed at the end of the day and I'm like, this day that just happened isn't here anymore. Where did it go? And wanting to have some kind of access to the past and looking for this sort of place in a historical continuum in a country that we live in that frankly is like kind of pushing against that instinct. You know, we, you know, like to think of ourselves as always, you know, as Americans, as like, you know, always looking forward, and there's not this sort of obsession with the past as much. And in Jewish life, I saw this sort of, first of all, obsession with text, which was great for me as a writer.
Right.
So, I mean, that was another place. I mean, like, literally, we're in a tradition where people kiss books.
Right.
Right. People dance with books. People kiss books. So, like, I mean, this is like a real great place to be as a writer.
Yeah.
But also, this problem of time, right, is kind of, I wouldn't say it's solved by Jewish life, but this idea of what do we do living as mortals in a world that outlasts us? Like, what is our role in that? And how do we sort of access this, like, longer continuum of human life? There's this attitude in Jewish tradition that, you know, the past is always present, right? And you see that, like, at, you know, the Seder, right? Like, whereas, you know, every generation you see yourself as if you personally came out of Egypt. You know, we all were standing at Sinai. Like, this really resonated with me.
Do you still experience that feeling of wanting to hold on to time, that it's, you know, slipping through your grasp? Or has that, you know, have you grown out of that, let's say?
It's the thing I'm always writing about.
Mm-hmm.
It's the thing I'm always writing about. I don't experience it. No, not the same way that I did when I was younger. When I was younger, I was like, you know, keeping these obsessive journals and things like that. And I don't do that anymore. As an adult, that's not what's motivating me. I'm thinking more about how to bring that access to the past to a broader audience.
Mm-hmm.
But that's because I think, you know, I'm in the situation where I'm, you know, I'm a public figure writing about these issues.
Right.
So it's almost like it's been turned inside out for me in a way.
Cool. You want a trip to Israel and Poland to go on March of the Living as a 14-year-old and wrote an article with your journal excerpts that was nominated for a National Magazine Award. So you were already overachieving at 14 years old.
That's a deep cut. I'm very impressed.
Yeah. What did you have to say about your experience in Israel and Poland that, you know, clearly resonated so much with people?
I mean, it's so funny because now I look back at this and this is sort of the beginning of People Love Dead Jews, which at the time, you know, it's funny because that, you know, trip March of the Living is very much doing that kind of juxtaposition of like the Holocaust and Israel. And in a way that
it does show you how we're continuing on.
Yes, it does. You know, it also, it is framed around the Holocaust and Israel as a response to the Holocaust,
right,
in a way that I, as an adult, don't really see it that way.
Mm-hmm.
The problem with that is that the state of Israel is not a response to the Holocaust.
Right.
This isn't like, you know, a consolation prize from the UN, right, you know, for like, sorry about the Holocaust. Like, this is, it's just like, it doesn't make any sense to think of it that way because that's not what happened. That
Do you
isn't,
think from
you
the
know,
minds of the UN, it was a little bit of that?
I think it's not like, oh, you know, the world, like, you know, felt bad for the Jews after the Holocaust.
No.
I mean,
it's definitely framed that way.
No, I think it's that there's this refugee crisis.
We got to stick them
after
somewhere.
The Holocaust. And guess what? Nobody wants those people.
Right.
Nobody wants those people. Guess why nobody wants those people? Same reason they didn't want them in 1935. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, you know, so this idea that this was like, yay, consolation prize. Hooray, you earned, you know, we're giving you a state. First of all, like thinking of it that way undermines the entire, you know, 50 plus years of the modern Zionist movement that built all these institutions without having a state.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And also building on, you know, ancient Jewish communities that had been there for thousands of years. And so there were always were immigrations to the land of Israel whenever it was possible. I mean, why do you think there was this whole, you know, Jewish community in Sfat in the, you know, 1400s, right? I mean, how were they there if there were, you know, people just showed up after the Holocaust? Like, no, that's not, I mean, like, there,
right,
you know, like the Jewish community in Hebron, right? I mean, these were Jewish community in Jerusalem. I mean, these were, you know, ancient communities. I see those issues differently now than I did when I was much younger. What that trip really did was, you know, for me, it was this access point to this broader historical consciousness. And it was the beginning of me becoming curious about what was lost in this European Jewish civilization. And it was also the beginning of me becoming curious about what is the real essence of Israeli culture and civilization. And if I hadn't gone on that trip at that time, I don't know that I would have pursued what I pursued academically in terms of Hebrew and Yiddish literature.
Interesting.
You know, look, that piece got a lot of attention. As you said, it was nominated for a National Magazine Award. That was, you know, the beginning of me writing for a broader audience because, you know, that sort of gave me an opportunity to write for a lot of different places. But it always was a little uncomfortable, right? Because, you know, I'm writing about the Holocaust. And I remember feeling a little bit uncomfortable about the fact that this was sort of the topic that had brought me these opportunities. And I remember sort of trying to write about that problem a few years later, like when I was, you know, maybe beginning of college, I remember like sitting and trying to write an essay about why there was something a little bit off about this.
Just like feeling a little icky that, like, you're getting recognition.
I didn't know about icky, but just not icky, but sort of feeling like, not that there's something wrong with this, but that there's something missing. And not really understanding how to articulate it and trying. And I remember that was one of the few times in my life where I started writing something and I'm like, this is too hard. I can't do it. Mm. And I abandoned it. And I didn't even think about it again until I was in my 40s and I was writing People Love Dead Jews.
Wow.
And basically People Love Dead Jews is that essay.
That's so interesting.
Yeah, that I didn't write after writing that piece.
Your first novel in 2002, In the Image, National Jewish Book Award winner. And this one does deal with the Holocaust.
A little bit.
A little bit?
A little bit, yes. There's a character who's a European Jewish refugee.
Right.
We now call those people Holocaust survivors, but that's only because there are so few Holocaust survivors that the bar keeps dropping for what we consider a Holocaust survivor.
Mm.
Like now, if you left Europe before, you know, being put in a concentration camp, you count as a survivor.
Right.
Yeah. When I was growing up, that wasn't true. We called those people refugees.
Interesting.
Yeah. In fact, people were even reluctant to call themselves survivors if they hadn't been in a concentration camp when I was growing up.
I understand that.
Yeah. Like my husband's grandparents we now would call survivors. They never would have called themselves that way because they're like, well, I was never in a concentration camp because they were in hiding. But those people didn't call themselves survivors.
Interesting. All other nights, Civil War period, not one usually associated with Jews.
No, never.
I love the Civil War time. I've read so much about it. I find it such a fascinating time. What drew you to tell that story?
It's funny because I was drawn to write that story because of how polarized America in general and the American Jewish community I felt had become.
This came out in 2009?
Yeah, yeah, I know. It's like, how hilarious is this, right? That it's wow, look how polarized we are in 2009.
Right.
The Jewish community in the United States in, you know, in 1860, it's obviously a much smaller community. It was like 150,000 Jews, but like, you know, largest community, not surprising at that time, was in New York City. Second largest community was in New Orleans.
Interesting.
But what was interesting to me was that there were like all the national churches, for example, a lot of those churches divided when the country, like when the South seceded. So like even today, there's like Southern Baptists, Southern Methodists.
Right.
That's left over from a schism in those national governing bodies of those churches from 1860, right? There were national Jewish groups in 1860, like B'nai B'rith already existed. There are a couple others that don't exist today. None of them split in 1860. And part of it's because the community is pretty small, but also it's because like Jewish community at that time was actually more similar to 21st century Jews in that, and less similar to their neighbors in that they were, there's a very mobile community. Like they mostly weren't farmers, you know, they mostly were, you know, merchants and, you know, other people who were part of like merchant networks. They had family members in different parts of the country. So like most Americans, when the country split, like they didn't know people.
Right.
On the other side of the line, and the Jews usually did. Something very weird happens when you publish a book about the Civil War, which is that people show up to your book events in costume.
In their, like, reenactment costumes?
Oh, yeah, they show up, like, people show up at my readings that, like, you know, Confederate uniform.
Only
like,
in
their
the South?
Musket, and, no,
all
like,
over?
In Pennsylvania, and, yeah,
Pennsylvania,
other places.
Sure.
Yeah, people would show up with their outfits and everything, and they'd tell you about how, like, you know, oh, every year I go to Gettysburg, and I set up my tent and I, you know, we reenact the battle and I'm like, wow, you're crazy. But then I go home and I'm building a sukkah in my backyard.
Right.
Right. And I'm like, you know, Jews are like, you know, the original reenactors, right?
There you
it's
go.
Like they're eating hardtack, we're eating matzah. You know,
it's the same thing.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, yeah.
I'm going to briefly mention your book, Eternal Life, which I'm listening to the audiobook of it now. And my son, who is six, was listening in the car and he heard the narrator say Rachel. And he was like, that's Hebrew. And I just like, I love that he was so psyched that there was like a Jewish story being told with Hebrew in it, which makes me also want to ask, do you have a non-Jewish audience for your work? And have you heard from them? And what do they say about what you write?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's actually a great example of the book you mentioned, Eternal Life. So that's, it's about a woman, Rachel, who can't die. It's actually, it's the opposite of People Love Dead Jews, right?
Yeah.
It's about a Jewish woman who can't die, who's been alive for 2,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the reason she's been alive for 2,000 years is because of a vow she took in the ancient temple in Jerusalem, and then the temple's destroyed and she can't get out of this vow. It's obviously this kind of metaphor for Jewish history. That book in particular is very attractive to non-Jewish readers because it's the ancient parts of that book are set in Roman-occupied Jerusalem. It's really kind of a book about the Jewish revolt against Rome. And for Christian readers, that's very resonant because that's the time of Jesus.
Right.
Right. Like, it's funny, actually, I have the editor of that book, she is not Jewish. And she, I remember editing that book, there was some minor comment she made about some historical thing. And she's like, you know, this detail felt a little off to me, but of course I know you know much more than I do about the biblical period. And then like, I hung up the phone and then like a little while later, I'm thinking like, there's nothing in this book that takes place in the biblical period. And then I realized, wait a minute, for Christians, the Roman occupied Jerusalem is the biblical period.
Right.
Right. Because that's the Christian Bible is in that setting.
That's
right. So that's like very resonant for people.
Yeah.
So it's like all my books are written in a way that's like accessible to any English language reader.
This is the kind of content that I've talked about on the show a lot that I want to see more on screen.
Yes.
Where it's universally appealing stories, but the characters are Jewish and the themes are Jewish and you're getting introduced to Jewish people and ideas and culture that way, but the vehicle itself is an entertainment.
Yes, of course.
You know, have you ever had anything optioned?
Yes, I haven't had anything made.
Yeah, we gotta
actually
get something
made.
Yeah,
although actually Eternal Life, there is somebody who's super interested in not only optioning that, but wants me to write the screenplay.
Cool.
Unfortunately, I've had to put a pin in that because my hair is on fire with all
right.
of these other things going on. And I'm sort of like, you know, I'm trying to get this nonprofit off the ground. So I'm kind of putting a pin in that for now.
So now I want to talk about your latest book, which I have right here, called One Little Goat. This is brand new, just came out. Give me the log line. Let's start there.
Sure. It's for young readers, as we say. It's a graphic novel.
What does young readers mean?
What's young readers, according to the publisher, middle grade, which is like 8 to 12. But okay. Like, it's very like, you know, it's like grungy, subversive. I kind of feel like, honestly, it could be, you know, teenagers also, mm-hmm. quite frankly. This is a book about a family at a Passover Seder where they cannot find their afikoman, mm-hmm. Which probably listeners to this podcast know what that is.
Most of them do.
Yeah. So, you know, it's this piece of matzah that you hide during the Seder. And then, you know, the Seder can't end without the afikoman, but this family can't find theirs. And as a result, they're trapped at the Seder for 6 months.
Right.
And then 6 months in, there's a knock on the door. I mean, you know, and it's like this crazy situation where, you know, their hair's growing long and the food's regenerating on the table. They're driving each other insane. It's a bit of a COVID vibe.
Yeah.
And then 6 months in, there's a knock on the door. The oldest kid in the family goes to answer the door. It's a talking goat. Mm-hmm. Who says, I'm the scapegoat. I'm the reason for all your problems. And he says, I can help you find this afikoman. And the kid says, great, where is it? And the goat says, oh, no, not where, when. And he says, while you've been trapped at this Seder during these past 6 months, thousands of years of previous Seders have accumulated underneath your Seder. You now have to travel down into those Seders to find your afikoman. So it becomes this sort of journey through Jewish history.
I read it. I loved it. I thought that was really cool. First of all, why'd you write a book for young readers? Why is this the audience?
You know, I started it thinking about this graphic novel form and, you know, how fun it would be to do something like that. Yeah. I sort of had this in the back of my head and, you know, I kind of parked it. And then at some point I was on a road trip with my family and we stopped at some comic book shop and my kids like went nuts in this comic book shop. And one of the books they came home with was by this indie cartoonist, Theo Ellsworth, who now is my collaborator. It was a book of his called Capacity. Real thick indie comics volume, really very, very surreal and amazing. And my kids were fighting over this book. And I was like, what is this book that you guys are obsessed with? And I took it and I was just like enchanted by his artwork. Like he's very like edgy, kind of subversive things that he does. But like he turns abstract ideas into physical things. Mm. You know, I was thinking about him and I had this is an idea I've been thinking about since I was a child.
Which aspect of it?
This idea that when you're sitting at the Seder, at the Passover Seder, you're sitting on top of all of these thousands of previous Seders. Mm. Just feeling like this is a moment when you have that access to the past. And so when you talked about, you know, writing for children, there's a lot of this like portal fiction for children, right? Where there's like some portal to another world, right? Yeah. Or like whether it's, you know, like Harry Potter, you know, you go through on the 9.5 platform or whatever.
Yeah.
Narnia, like there's a lot of that kind of stuff where it's like there's some portal from your ordinary life to this like magical world. There's a reason that kids want that, right?
I love that stuff.
Well, I mean, a lot of people love that stuff. And the reason people love it is because they feel their lives are very confined to where, you know, they feel like their lives are small.
Yeah.
And children's lives actually are small. And so that's why children crave that like portal. But, you know, I think also in Jewish tradition, it's like we basically have made that portal to this broader life, right? Like, when you live your life as a Jew, your life is always bigger than your life.
Right.
Right? You are always sort of partaking of this like vast civilizational chain. You could say all humans are, but like in Judaism, that is like made literal, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's like this active thing where it's like, you know, every person sees themselves as if they came out of Egypt.
Right.
And so I just thought like, what an amazing opportunity to sort of give children like that portal into this bigger life, which they actually do have, right? Children and the Passover story is all about like inviting children into that, right?
Right.
I mean, the whole purpose of the Passover Seder is to engage children in this civilizational chain.
Yeah. What is your Passover like? I mean, you talked about how, like, what's you turning it up to 11, your childhood, you know, performance?
As I said, I have four children. It's mm-hmm. actually a lot of, it's a very child heavy Seder because my
parents. You're one of four yourself.
I'm one of four. Yeah. So my parents have 14 grandchildren.
Yeah.
We are traditional in that we do every single page of the Haggadah, but we're very not traditional in that we use technology. So what was important to me was it was important to me to be able to do every page of the Haggadah, but I've got like a room full of rowdy children.
Right.
So I'm like, how do I involve people?
Please enlighten me.
Yes. Oh my God. So every single page of the Haggadah, we do special effects.
Okay.
Full-blown special effects. So I'm just going to give you a
tiny taste.
We build out our basement into a walkthrough experience.
Wow.
So we put up like black paper paneling that we paint with neon paint, and we have black lights. Part of it is like an Egyptian tomb, and part of it is an Egyptian palace. We have another room that's like done up with like, you know, painted like stone walls and like, you know, those artificial candles where it's like you're in the Israelites' home where they're sacrificing a lamb, you know, and then we have another room where like, you know, you're in the Egyptian palace with the Pharaoh's son, and then the angel of death pops out of a closet with a scythe and like takes him down. And then, you know, there's sort
it's
of like
a haunted house for Passover.
Totally, yeah, it's
like,
exactly. It's, that and, was the model.
You, is it being narrated as you walk through?
There are actors.
There are actors.
Yeah, yeah. My four children are the actors in this, and then, or sometimes my husband and I will play certain roles, and the rest of our guests are walking through, and we break them into groups of, you know, three or four people at a time.
Oh my
gosh. And then we
come through.
Oh, I didn't finish it though, because then when
sorry.
You come out at the after you leave this basement, you into our garage. We have set up in the garage, it's a laser swamp. Do you know what that is?
No.
Like you put, well, we do this with blue lasers at waist height, and then we've got fog machines.
Right,
and
so you can
then
see the lasers through the fog.
Well, it fills up with fog only up to the point of the lasers, so there's a surface to the lasers. You're walking through a waist high surface, which looks like water, and it parts in front of you as you walk through it.
Wow.
So it's like you're parting the sea. So
it's
I mean,
very
this
high
is like
production value.
Yeah. Oh, very, very high. I haven't even gotten into like that's like the tiniest piece of what we do. I mean, we have plague drops. We have like, you know, 150 ping pong balls that fall from the ceiling. Oh, well, also all the kids in the family are assigned, and this is participatory for the kids as well. This we assigned it a month in advance. We make a movie every year of the entire Passover story. We split up the parts of the story for the different, you know, groups of kids in the family. And every year they put on a different production of whatever that is, of that story. And it's like, it's hilarious.
This
like
is unbelievable.
I mean, we did one, like I remember my kids got assigned a couple years ago, the one of the wild beasts. It's like one of the plagues.
Right.
And they did this parody of the movie Cocaine Bear, where it was Chametz Bear.
Hey.
And it's like the bear like digging into this like bag of flour.
That's funny.
It's hilarious. Yeah, so it's like, you know, every year is something totally different.
How do you guys handle the dry portion of the Haggadah?
We screen these pieces of the movie.
So someone gets assigned on the outstretched arm page.
So that outstretched arm, this is the Wandering Aramaean paragraph. So that's like a whole other piece that we do where my daughter is the Wandering Aramaean and she puts on this like out costume where she's got like a beard and a robe, and we film her walking around in like through Newark Airport.
This is the like,
you know, or she like gets onto New Jersey Transit.
Anyone has like ever put into any Jewish holiday ever.
I mean, you have no idea. Like I could keep going. We
can
have a whole podcast just about what we do at my Seder. I mean, it's like, you know, I've unfortunately raised the bar so high that now we're like, oh my God, how are we going to top this this year?
How many hours, man hours, would you say go into this Seder?
Well, I've made a rule that we don't plan anything until after Purim. Purim is exactly 4 weeks before Pesach.
Okay, so
y'all
four
weeks
before
Passover.
That hour, to that
yeah, because otherwise I would go nuts. Although like the rest of the year, like, well, I mean, I will tell you that like, you know, many times we'll go to the Halloween store on November 1st and be like, is there anything good here that we might want to buy? Like, you know,
we got the Google Doc going all
yeah,
year
sir,
of ideas.
No, we were thinking about it.
I love that, and it's absolutely insane, and I love it.
It's completely insane. Like, I don't know what I'm doing to myself.
All right, Tara, we're going to bring it home after this incredible, thought-provoking, deep discussion with a little lightning round, as we like to do here on Being Jewish. I mean, maybe we know the answer already, but what's your favorite Jewish holiday?
Yeah, I think you know.
Okay. It speaks for itself. Least favorite Jewish holiday?
Probably something, you know, these minor ones like Tu B'Shvat. Like,
what's wrong with Tu B'Shvat?
I don't know. It's like, well, because you're living in North America and this is like, you know, New Year of the trees. And I'm like, there's snow on the ground.
Right.
Right.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. That goes back to that. You know, these are, you know, practices that are related to the microclimate of the land of Israel. So, yeah, it's hard to connect in North America to that.
Who are one or some of your favorite Jewish voices today that you like to consume?
My dear friend, Sarah Hurwitz, who I know is, you know, also been in this podcast.
She has. And she's one of mine as well.
She's fantastic. And I mean, she's got a book other people haven't read yet, but I've had the good fortune to read. So pre-order it now as a Jew.
Yeah. Yeah.
Coming out in the fall. I love her. There's some people like in terms of writing about this topic who, you know, have sort of changed some of my thinking about it. Somebody like Enot Wilf.
Mm-hmm.
She's like more like a political theorist.
Yeah.
I'm really interested in her work. You know, from a very different perspective, somebody like Yossi Klein Halevi.
Sure.
Is really interesting in this perspective. My dear friend, Mati Friedman, who's an Israeli journalist.
Mm-hmm.
I think his stuff is really, really insightful.
I've definitely got one of his books on
my
shelf.
Yeah. You should have him on this. He's amazing. Yeah,
okay.
He's fantastic.
I'll have you set it up.
Yeah.
You get off the plane in Israel. You're going straight to blank.
Probably to see my husband's family.
Oh, nice.
Yeah.
Which where do they live?
They're in Givatayim.
Which is where?
Yeah, it's like it's part of Tel Aviv, basically.
If you could have anyone from the past at your Shabbat table, who would it be?
Maybe Avram Sutzkever.
Who is that?
Who is that? He's a superhero who you've never heard of.
Yeah.
He's probably the greatest Yiddish writer of the 20th century.
Say his name again slower.
Avram Sutzkever.
Sutzkever.
Yes. He's a hero of the partisans of the Vilna Ghetto.
Mm.
He was involved in this paper brigade, which was rescuing the treasures of YIVO, the Institute for Jewish Research, which was this giant archive of Jewish texts in Vilna that now it's in Union Square in New York City at YIVO.
Wow.
And then, you know, rebuilt Yiddish speaking culture in Israel after the war, basically single-handedly, you know, created Yiddish publishing in Israel after the war. I mean, he lived a long life. He only died in, I think, 2010.
Is there anything in English written about him?
So there's translations of his. There are actually now, very recently, there's been a bunch of translations of his work.
Okay, great.
So you can find, his testimony at the Nuremberg trials and his documents from the Vilna Ghetto.
Fantastic.
But yeah, there's a lot of his poetry is also available in English.
Okay, great. If you could live in any other era, which era would it be?
Oh, man. They all suck. We're so lucky. Yeah.
Good answer.
We're so lucky.
Great.
Yeah.
What's your favorite Passover song?
Well, I wrote a whole book based on Chad Gadya.
That's probably my favorite too. My family goes in on that one.
The truth about Chad Gadya is it probably is just like a drinking song that was imported from something else and that was sort of, you know, there's, you know, after four cups of wine, there's a bunch of drinking songs at the end of the Haggadah.
Right.
But like, I love there's one interpretation of that song that's about how this is actually a metaphor for Jewish history because it's, you know, one little goat my father bought for two zuzim, and then the cat eats the goat and all these other creatures that eat each other and attack each other. That the goat is the Jewish people. My father is God.
Mm-hmm.
The two zuzim that the father buys him for are the two tablets of the Ten Commandments.
Okay.
And then all of these other elements that come in the song, these animals and these things that attack each other are these empires that conquered the Jewish people over many years. And so it's like, and I forget the correlation. It's like the cat is, I think, the Babylonians who destroyed the temple. It's like the Babylonians, the Persians, the Greeks, the Romans, it goes up to like the last one from, you know, it's probably, I think it's the Crusaders, you know, who massacred Jews in the Rhineland. And then it's, you know, at the end, it's sort of, you know, God kills the angel of death. And
right.
It's sort of this like, this like hope for the future that you're going to break through this cycle.
That's nice. I'm going to bring that to my Seder.
Yeah.
Okay. Last thing. Can you leave my audience with either some food for thought or some call to action in the Hineni moment that we're in right now?
Yeah, we've been talking a lot about Passover in this conversation because, you know, one little goat, I have a Passover book coming out.
Mm-hmm.
I've often said to Jewish audiences that I feel like this is a Queen Esther moment for us. If you think about the Purim story is about these Jews in a diaspora community, right, in the Persian Empire. And, you know, there's this, you know, call for the genocide of Jews.
Yep.
And, you know, at first, you know, Queen Esther is in this position where she has this opportunity to influence the king. And, you know, her uncle Mordechai says to her, you know, you need to act. You need to tell the king, you know, to stop this decree. And she's like, but if I go to the king and uninvited, I could be killed. And that reminds me of that like college student who's like, you know, I didn't say anything because, you know, if I would, I might have been doxxed or I might have been, you know, pilloried online. But then he says, you know, maybe this is the reason you became queen, to use your power in this moment.
Mm.
As the Jewish people in the 21st century, this is our Queen Esther moment. And what's funny to me is that like when she goes to the king, like the king actually turns out to be on her side. You know, like most people are not malicious, right? Most people are just ignorant. He's like, oh, it's like, did I sign that decree? I must have been drunk.
Right.
We are so fortunate in this country to have this opportunity to be part of this conversation where we can, you know, really take control of our lives and our community, not take control of our communities, but participate in our communities and change the conversation. And that's what I'm hoping to do with my nonprofit. That's what I've been trying to do with all of my work. But I think it's something that all of us can do is, you know, participate in those conversations and really
use platform, your role, wherever it is, wherever you are to do something.
Yes, this is your Queen Esther moment where you can stand up against hatred.
Dara, thank you so much for everything. This was such a great discussion. This was so satisfying for me. So happy to have you here. Thank you.
Thank you for everything you're doing. I'm really, I've look to you and your guests for really defining this moment. And it's really, you're doing fantastic work. So thank you.
Thank you. And One Little Goat is out now. You can get it online, bring it to your Passover Seder, give it as an Afikoman finding prize. It's fantastic. You won't regret it. Dara, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I want to thank Dr. Dara Horn for her vital wisdom, for helping all of us open our eyes a bit more, and thank her many ancestors through the generations for helping her to be here with us today. I want to wish Dara and all of you who celebrate Chag Pesach Sameach a very happy and meaningful Passover to you all. Be like Dara, bring some meaning into your Seder, try something new. And as we say every year, B'Shana Haba'ah B'Yerushalayim, next year may we be in Jerusalem. I'll see y'all back here for the next liberating episode of Being Jewish with me, Jonah Platt. Big ups to everyone who makes this show possible every week. My executive producer, Matthew Jones, story producer, Sean Livyashvili, and editor, Mike O'Brien of Rainbow Creative, consulting producer, Bethany Mandel, research associate, Samantha Greenwald, my amazing executive assistant, Josie Rothschild, social media manager, Yuval Yosha, and graphic designer extraordinaire, Noah Bell. Most of all, thanks to you, dear listeners, who even stuck around to listen to all these credits. Man, I freaking love you guys.